During the annihilation of the British army by the Zulus at the Battle of Isandlwana in 1879, two British officers, Lieutenants Melville and Coghill, made a desperate escape, trying to carry the Queen's colour to safety. It became one of those legendary moments in Victorian history, depicted in paintings, and also in the film Zulu Dawn. But were they really heroes trying to save the colour? Or were they merely trying to save their own skins? It's time to uncover the controversies surrounding Melville and Coghill and saving the Queen's colour at the Battle of Isandlwana. Hi, I'm Chris Green, the History Chap, telling stories that bring British history to life. I have related the story of the Battle of Isandlwana in a recent episode, 104 if you want to check it out, so I'll give you a very quick overview to put this particular story into context. Are you ready? Having invaded Zululand, Lord Chelmsford, the British commander, divided his force into two and set off eastwards to meet the expectant Zulu army, whilst leaving the remainder, approximately 1,700 men, at the camp at Isandlwana. Included in their number were 700 British regulars from the 24th Regiment of Foot. The Zulus, however, were not to the east. In a brilliant piece of deception and organisation, their army of 25,000 men had bypassed Chelmsford, and on the 22nd of January, they launched a highly disciplined and courageous attack on the British garrison at Isandlwana. And again, if you want to hear the exact reasons for what happened next, then please listen to episode 104 about the battle itself. Whilst the British pinned down the Zulu attackers with volley rifle fire, the Zulu right horn had successfully moved behind Isandlwana mountain and now charged into the undefended rear of the British camp. Lieutenant Colonel Pullen from the 24th Foot, whom Lord Chelmsford had left in charge, ordered his troops to fall back. As the buglers sounded this message, the Zulus charged en masse. And as the soldiers fell back, they were surrounded by Zulu warriors who picked them off in small groups. Several companies tried to form squares, keeping the Zulus back with well-disciplined rifle fire, and when the ammunition ran out, they defended themselves with their bayonets. What had up until that moment been a well-ordered British defence suddenly turned into a chaotic rout. And there was only one escape route left, Fugitive's Trail. But before we travel that terrifying trail, let's head back into the pandemonium of the camp for a crucial part of our story. The start of a heroic legend, and also a military controversy. While some regular units, such as the remnants of F Company of the 1st Battalion, 24th Foot, under Lieutenant Edgar Anstey, tried to remain together and conduct a fighting retreat, most of those fleeing were simply a disorganised rabble. Mounted colonial soldiers, officers from the artillery whose guns had overturned as they retreated pell-mell into the camp, civilian interpreters, wagoners, individual redcoats. It was during these last minutes in the camp that Lieutenant Colonel Pullen rode with Lieutenant Melville to the tent housing the Queen's colour of the 1st Battalion, 24th Foot. The colours were the flags of the regiment, and were a very visible rallying point on a battlefield for soldiers. Highly symbolic, there could be no greater dishonour and calamity for an infantry regiment than to lose their colours. Men would quite literally fight to the death to protect them. Actually, infantry regiments had two colours. The regimental colour, which bears the regiment's insignia on either a Cross of St George or a plain background, traditionally the colour of the lining of their red coat jacket. And then there's the Queen's or King's colour, with the regiment's name within a gold circle in the centre of a Union Jack. At this time, as infantry regiments were numbered rather than having geographic or other names, the name on that gold background was simply the regimental number in Roman numerals. And it was the Queen's colour of the 1st Battalion of the 24th Foot that Colonel Pullen retrieved from the tent in those frantic last minutes. For the record, their regimental colour was with a company still in Natal making their way to join Chelmsford's column at Isandlwana. Both colours of the 2nd Battalion of the 24th Foot were also here in the camp, but in a separate tent, which had already been seized by the Zulus. Pullen handed the Queen's colour to Lieutenant Melville, supposedly saying, "You as senior subaltern will take the colours and make your way from here." Melville took the sacred colour, saluted his colonel, and then wheeled his horse away, joining the throng fleeing the destruction in the camp. Teaming up with Lieutenant Coghill, who was wearing a blue tunic, the two men heroically galloped out of the camp and into Victorian legend. Lieutenant Timothy Melville was born in London in 1842. Having been educated at Harrow School and Cambridge University, he was seen as a rising star in the British Army. Indeed, shortly before the Zulu War, whilst in Cape Town, he had successfully passed the exams to Staff College. Some of you may know that Staff College is like the British Army's university for high-potential staff officers, of whom only 30 from the whole army were selected each year back in this time. Meanwhile, Lieutenant Neville Coghill was born in Drumcondra, now a suburb of Dublin, and came from the Anglo-Irish aristocracy. An ambitious officer, coming up to his 27th birthday, he'd been serving as aide-de-camp, or ADC, to the British High Commissioner in South Africa, Sir Bartle Frere, but as the war clouds gathered, he'd requested that he return to his regiment, the 24th Foot. On the 20th of January, while scouting ahead of the advancing British Army with Lord Chelmsford, he'd fallen whilst chasing a fowl and dislocated his kneecap. Hardly able to walk, Coghill had been left in the camp when Chelmsford took half his force east that morning in search of the Zulus. And now the two officers were joining the desperate and terrified throng running the terrifying and bloody gauntlet of fugitives' trail, an escape route that turned rapidly into a graveyard. The men escaping the camp had to fight their way through the very tips of the two Zulu horns that were coming together to trap those still in the camp. Zulus were peeling away from the horns in pursuit of these fugitives, running in and out of the fleeing masses of troops. Personally, I cannot imagine the sheer terror and physical efforts that must have confronted those men fleeing down this route, hoping to reach safety. It's still known as Fugitives' Trail. Trail gives the idea that it was some sort of path or track. It was neither. It was 8 miles of broken countryside. Can you imagine being a British soldier in a heavy woolen tunic and woolen trousers, wearing steel-shod boots, trying to run 8 miles in the African summer? Behind you, you can hear the battle cries of Zulu warriors, fleet-footed, not weighed down with a uniform, used to this terrain. It didn't take long for those warriors to overhaul the fugitives from Isandlwana. And as you were struggling across this broken countryside, every now and then you might see a Zulu darting towards you out of the corner of your eye and try to accelerate. Maybe you'd take him out with a bullet, or a bayonet, or the butt of your rifle, if you still had one. Stumbling across a small stream, passing acacia trees and aloe plants, your hands and face being torn as you stumble through tough thorn bushes that litter the route. More dry dongas or gullies to climb down into and then climb up the other side. Probably no water left to quench your thirst on a day that's remembered by many survivors, both British and Zulus, as eerily hot and still. Even on a normal January day, the average temperature at this time of the day in this part of the world is in the upper 80s Fahrenheit or 30 Celsius. And all the time, the Zulus running in and out, stabbing the fleeing throng with their assegais. Men on horses passing by, injured men lying, calling for help, even some frightened camp cattle joining in this rush. 8 whole miles. Any reserves of adrenaline must have been used up long before they finally looked down from the escarpment onto the Buffalo River, the border between Zululand and British Natal. And now the horror continued, gingerly having to pick a route down that steep slope, only to find the river in full flood. Men milling around on the bank, trying to work out how and where to cross. Even mounted men who were trying to cling onto their horses and swim across the river were in trouble as they hit submerged rocks, or exhausted, were just swept down the river. Below was a small waterfall, with 3 horses going round and round in circles in the raging waters, their riders washed away. For those who'd got this far on foot, it was the end of the line. Utterly exhausted, in heavy clothing, those who tried to cross went under. Many couldn't even swim. And the Zulus were swarming above them, throwing their spears, firing rifles, and running in for the kill. Not a single white soldier, or civilian, on foot made it across the river. In total, just 55 Europeans made it to safety, and all of them were on horses, and none of them were wearing a red coat. And it was into this terrifying scene that Melville and Coghill plunged with the Queen's colour. Could they save it? Coghill managed to hang on to his horse as it swam its way to the Natal bank. Behind him, however, Melville's horse collided with a rock and threw the subaltern into the fast-flowing flood waters. Still grasping the colour, Melville was swept towards a large flat rock. Clinging onto that rock was an officer from the Natal native contingent, Lieutenant Higginson. Melville shouted to him to help, and Higginson grabbed hold of the pole of the colour. The force of the river and Higginson's weakness now swept the colonial officer back into the waters with Melville. Struggling in the waters, and with the Zulus now firing at them from the Zulu bank, the unfolding drama was witnessed by an interpreter named Bickhill. As Bickhill watched on, he saw Coghill turn his horse and spur it back from the Natal bank into the water. And as his horse swam towards the men, it was shot in the head. Somehow the three men managed to make it to the relative safety of the Natal bank. But looking around, Melville realised that he'd lost the colour somewhere in the raging Buffalo River. With the Queen's colour lost, Melville, Coghill and Higginson started to climb up the steep bank away from the river. By now, Coghill's dislocated kneecap was severely hampering their progress, and as they made painfully slow progress, Coghill suddenly shouted, "Here they come!" as two armed Zulus approached from beneath them, and then, "I'm done up, I can't go any further." Imploring the officers of the 24th to use their revolvers to slow up their pursuers, Higginson went ahead to try and secure some horses from a group of mounted Basotos from the Natal Mounted Infantry who were giving covering fire to the fugitives down in the drift. Having successfully obtained those horses, Higginson was descending back down when he heard a short fight and a group of Zulus appear from where he'd left the officers. It didn't take a genius to know that Coghill and Melville were dead. Higginson turned tail and rode off into Natal. But the story was not over yet. As the legend of Melville and Coghill grew, so did a question. Should they receive a posthumous Victoria Cross? And that in turn created some embarrassing questions about their conduct. In particular, were they saving the colour or simply saving their skins? The British army at Isandlwana was annihilated. Yet the Zulu victory wasn't total. Chelmsford's force that he had taken east was still intact, and whilst the weary Zulus headed home, his depleted column withdrew from Zululand, crossing the border into British Natal at Rorke's Drift. It was from here that a patrol was sent out to find the bodies of Melville and Coghill on the 3rd of February. They were discovered exactly where Higginson had reported that he had left them. They were covered in assegai wounds, but both men were still fully clothed and hadn't been disemboweled, as was the Zulu custom. Around them lay several dead Zulus. Melville and Coghill might not have carried the colour to safety, but they had fought to the end. But in a strange way, they had carried the colour to safety, as you're going to find out in a moment. The following day, the party returned, and Coghill and Melville were buried where they'd fallen. The simple funeral service was presided over by Chaplain Smith from Rorke's Drift, who during the defence of the mission station had earned the nickname Ammunition Smith. Coghill was just 3 days short of his 27th birthday. Melville left a wife, Sarah, and two sons, one of whom, Charles Melville, would end up as a Major General in the New Zealand military forces and serve with them at Gallipoli and on the Western Front during the First World War. As they made their way down by the river, the party spotted a pole sticking up from some rocks. It was the flagpole lost by Melville in the river, and beneath it, heavily eroded from its 2 weeks submersion in the African waters, was the Queen's colour itself. The Queen's colour of the 1st Battalion of the 24th Regiment of Foot was, along with the regimental colour, presented to Queen Victoria later that year. The Queen placed a silver immortelles onto the pike, which can still be seen, along with both colours, at Brecon Cathedral in Wales. For the record, both colours of the 2nd Battalion, which were also at Isandlwana, were never recovered, although towards the end of the war, their flagpoles were found in a distant Zulu kraal. The Victorian public lapped up the heroic story of Melville and Coghill bravely trying to save the Queen's colour, especially in light of the humbling experience at Isandlwana. Alphonse de Neuville's epic painting of the men escaping the carnage of the battle became the official image of their daring ride. But the painting was not an accurate depiction of the event, and that wasn't the only controversy about their heroic ride. Nowadays, we tend to accuse filmmakers of embellishing historic stories for their audiences. Well, in a non-cinema age, painters were depicting scenes that they wanted their audiences to see, and were probably also reflecting what the audience wanted to see as well. De Neuville's painting is a case in point. Here we see Melville and Coghill fighting their way out of the camp, carrying the colour to safety. The problem was that the painter depicts Melville holding the regimental colour, which was safely in Natal, rather than the Queen's colour. Furthermore, every witness who saw Melville during his flight said the colour was not unfurled, but in a case, which, as Lieutenant Smith Dorian, who saw him at the Buffalo River, reported, was being carried across his saddle. But let's face it, A painting with a man with a large container is hardly going to make a heroic and exciting painting. But the painting exposes a far greater controversy, one that raises questions over what really happened and whether Coghill and maybe Melville were heroes or potentially cowards. The story of both men riding out of the camp together was recorded in the Regimental History of the South Wales Borderers, which is what the 24th Regiment of Foot later became. It was published in 1937, but it seems to be based on a popular myth that Alphonse de Neuville had captured in his painting. And this myth had started life in a report in a local Natal newspaper shortly after the battle, in a supposed eyewitness account, attributed to, quote, "a gentleman whose testimony can be relied upon," unquote. So who was this gentleman? We don't know. Although there is one possibility. Their commanding officer, Colonel Glynn. But why would Glynn make up this story? Well, because the alternative would be too hard to bear for their commanding officer, that they had deserted the camp and tried to save their skins. Chelmsford's replacement as Commander-in-Chief, General Sir Garnet Wolseley, believed it was monstrous that they had been made heroes, and wrote, quote, "I do not like the idea of officers escaping on horseback when their men on foot are killed," unquote. Not a single witness claimed that Melville left the camp with Coghill, as depicted in the famous painting. Colonel Glynn's groom, Private Williams, recalls seeing Melville leaving the camp with the colour, but alone. Lieutenant Henry Curling, an artillery officer, was one of the last men to get out before the two Zulu horns joined together. Riding as swiftly as he could, he caught up with Melville, but there was no sign of Coghill. Another fugitive, Lieutenant Smith Dorian, reported that as he approached a marshy area on the trail, he saw Coghill struggling on a stray horse ahead of him, but no mention of Melville being with him. Not only do witnesses not recall Melville and Coghill riding together, but they also mention catching up with Coghill. In other words, he had left the camp before men like Curling and Smith Dorian, which would indicate that Coghill left the camp a lot earlier than those fleeing the final mayhem. Amidst all the heroic stories of survival, there was an uncomfortable truth for the Victorian army and the Victorian public. The only men who made it to safety were men on horses. And here were two regular army officers escaping on horseback while 700 redcoats were being killed at Isandlwana. The gentleman who had given his testimony to the newspaper was also the source of the story about Pauline ordering Melville to carry the colour to safety and the young officer saluting and riding away. But was he actually carrying it to safety? Or was there another possibility? And I don't mean saving his skin. As I said earlier, the colours were not just a symbolic banner, but a rallying point. Did Pauline or Melville, acting on his own initiative, take the colour with the intention of making a stand? But the disintegration of the camp was swift. It's estimated that it was just 30 minutes from the bugle sounding that retreat to the last organised resistance being overcome in the camp. So if using the colour as a rallying point had been his intention, Melville might have realised that moment had already passed, and the new priority was just to save the colour itself. And there is another intriguing possibility concerning Coghill possibly leaving the camp earlier. Was he vainly trying to fetch reinforcements? What we do know is that with a dislocated knee, Coghill was no use performing any duties on foot, whereas he could, with some discomfort, ride a horse. As things started to get a little too hot for comfort, is it beyond the realms of possibility that Lieutenant Colonel Pauline ordered Coghill to ride towards Rook's Drift to summon as many guns to the camp as possible? B Company of the 2nd Battalion, 24th Foot, were at Rook's Drift, and two companies of the 1st Battalion were supposed to be making their way from nearby Helpmarker to the mission station. For all Pauline knew, they might have already arrived at the drift already. 300 extra British troops could have made a difference if they arrived in time. Maybe. So maybe Coghill hadn't left the camp with Melville trying to save the colour, but maybe he was on an equally heroic mission. You'll never know. The British press and public prefer to leave the awkward questions about who had left the camp when and whether they were trying to save their own lives whilst their men perished. After the humiliation handed out by the Zulus, they wanted some heroes. Two brave, dashing young officers saving the Queen's colour certainly fitted the bill. The cry went up that they should be awarded Victoria Crosses. but at that stage, there was no royal warrant for posthumous VCs. In 1907, after considerable lobbying, not least by Melville's widow, Sarah, and Coghill's father, Lieutenants Timothy Melville and Neville Coghill were awarded posthumous Victoria Crosses. Melville for saving the colour, Coghill for trying to save Melville in the river, and by default, the colour too. Both Victoria Crosses are on show at the Regimental Museum in Brecon. We will never really know what happened as Melville and Coghill rode from the camp. Were they acting heroically? Or were they saving their skins? There's enough eyewitness evidence to certainly suggest they didn't leave the camp together, as the Victorian painter suggested. What we do know is that Melville lost his horse in the river, and he and Higginson were being swept away, and it was Coghill who rode back from the relative safety of the Natal bank to assist them whilst under fire. Which seems strange, if he was merely intent on saving his own skin, doesn't it? What we also know is that once they reached dry land, Melville stuck with Coghill, even though the latter's disability prevented their escape. Chelmsford wrote to the War Office saying that effectively by sticking with Coghill, Melville had paid the ultimate price. So again, really saving their skins? I'm not sure. Whatever their motives, Melville carried the Queen's colour all the way to the Buffalo River. And there, it was recovered by the British on the 4th of February. So at the end of the day, the Queen's colour of the 1st Battalion, 24th Regiment of Foot, was indeed saved by Melville and Coghill from the enemy. Well, thanks for joining me today, and I hope you enjoyed this story and found it interesting. And if you did, then please consider supporting my channel or sign up for my newsletter at my website so you don't miss future episodes. Plenty more coming your way, including the Battle of Rorke's Drift, made famous in the film Zulu. But in the meantime, keep well, and I'll speak to you again very soon.